Hi, this is Dr. Bill Meyer. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Dr. Bill Meyer Live. You can hear the show live every Saturday from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m., and there are many more podcasts for this and all our other faith radio shows available on our website. You can just go to myfaithradio.com. And thanks so much for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
He's a psychologist, an author, and a veteran broadcaster. But most importantly, he's a dad. Welcome to Dr. Bill Meyer Live on the Faith Radio Network. Stay tuned for a faith and culture connection, a biblical perspective on current events, and practical family advice with psychologist Dr. Bill Meyer. You can join the conversation by calling 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Now, let's join Bill Meyer live.
Have you ever tried practicing the spiritual disciplines in your life? The inward disciplines of prayer and fasting, meditation, study. The outward disciplines of things like simplicity, solitude, submission, and service. And how about the corporate disciplines of confession, worship, guidance, and celebration? Today we're going to be talking to the son of Richard Foster, who was the theologian who wrote one of the classic books on the spiritual disciplines, and he's going to talk about his own struggle with the spiritual disciplines. How can you get it right? How can you practice the spiritual disciplines without becoming guilty, without becoming frustrated? I think those of us that have attempted to practice the disciplines may have had some of those experiences. And Nathan Foster will be coming up in just a minute talking about The Making of an Ordinary Saint, My Journey from Frustration to Joy with the Spiritual Disciplines. So stick with us for that. Hey, what causes Americans the most stress in their lives? You may not be surprised to learn that it's actually money. A new poll out commissioned by the American Psychological Association, and they found that money beat out work, family responsibilities, even health concerns as the number one stressor in our lives. Now, money has actually been listed as the top stressor for several years now, but this new poll found that our money worries could also be harming our health. Yeah, one in five Americans say in the past year they've actually skipped or considered skipping a visit to the doctor because of financial factors. And almost a third of the people in this poll said that lack of money prevents them from living a healthy lifestyle. So who feels the most strain when it comes to money? Well, parents, younger adults, and those with lower incomes tend to say they get the most stressed out about their bank account. Folks with children under 18 at home have higher levels of stress about money than non-parents. In fact, a full one-third of American parents say their overall stress has increased in the past year. And as a dad with a 12-year-old, a 10-year-old, and an 8-year-old at home, I would say, yeah, it can be kind of stressful, especially when you start adding up all the things that that your wife signed your kids up for. We were having a discussion about this week. Well, unfortunately, these survey results from the American Psychological Association also found that folks with higher levels of money stress are more likely to turn to unhealthy ways of coping with their stress. Things like watching television for more than 2 hours a day, or surfing the internet for hours at a time, eating too much, drinking alcohol, smoking. People are stressed about money, and then they tend to plunge into those sort of destructive behaviors. So what does the APA recommend? Well, interestingly, they say one of the answers is to reach out to other people for social and emotional support. And, of course, the Bible tells us the same thing. Galatians 6:2 says, "Carry each other's burdens, and in this way you will fulfill the law of Christ." I always love it when new psychological research comes out and it mirrors what we find in Scripture. And if we believe that all truth is God's truth, whether it's truth that is revealed to us in His created order, the world that He has designed and how He has designed us to best function, and we can learn those things through research and experimentation and things like that, or if it's truth through his word, his written word, his revealed word. Those things should not contradict each other. And I've often mentioned that when we find contradictions between God's revealed word in nature and his revealed word in scripture, we have to figure out what's going on, and often it's some kind of distortion, either in the way that we're doing our research, because, hey, we're limited, finite human beings, and we blow it. We have a sin nature, and sometimes we have our own agenda when it comes to what we're looking for in research, and any good researcher will tell you, you've got to look for bias, both on the part of the experimenter and the subjects, and then also there's the problem of distorted theology. We may be looking at the Bible through a lens that is clouded. And so when we find those contradictions, really, I believe they're only apparent contradictions that in truth. And of course, we won't know this until we're fully, in glory with God and he reveals these things to us. But those two things should always match up. And so I've seen more and more studies just in the past year that amaze me, because it's like right out of the words of the Bible. So here we have a study, that and the American Psychological Association says, you know what? People that are undergoing stress, especially about money, need to reach out to others for social and emotional support. And the Bible says to encourage one another and to bear one another's burdens and to pray for one another and of course, confess our faults to one another. And so it's wonderful when those two things tend to fit and go side by side. Hey, could watching YouTube videos make your teenager more likely to abuse alcohol? It looks that way. A bunch of research studies in the past have shown that media messages about alcohol can actually influence kids' attitudes about booze and make them more likely to drink. And in those earlier studies, they looked at things like TV shows and movies. But new research is suggesting that online videos could also have a negative impact on our kids. A team of researchers from the University of Texas sat down and watched 70 of the most popular YouTube videos dealing with intoxication, and they wanted to see what kinds of messages they were sending to kids. To do that, they searched for some of these terms: drunk, buzzed, hammered, tipsy, trashed. And then they chose the most popular videos that popped up in those categories on YouTube, and they coded them for how much alcohol was shown in the video, what type of characters were shown, and whether or not the video actually showed the consequences of things like binge drinking. Well, the videos with the most likes on YouTube tended to be funny, and the overall message of the video was upbeat and positive, especially when a specific brand of alcohol was mentioned. That's a little suspect, isn't it? Hard liquor was actually the most common beverage featured, and the videos hardly ever showed any of the negative impacts of getting drunk. Now, in this particular study, they weren't trying to actually make a connection between watching the videos and whether or not kids drink more or drink more dangerously, but I think these findings really do shed some light on how much of what kids see on YouTube is alcohol-related, and how it could impact them. If what holds true, with movies and television shows holds true with online videos, and there's no reason that it shouldn't. Certainly our kids could be influenced. And of course, from a Christian perspective, mom and dad, if you haven't had a talk with your kids about alcohol and drugs, you need to do that. And you need to do it early, because the research would show that the first time that kids are in an environment where alcohol and drugs are readily available is when they enter middle school. There is a big difference between the environment in elementary school and the environment in middle school. And most kids that are in middle, and my son just started middle school this year, most kids in middle school would be able to tell you who has the drugs, who can get you alcohol. And it's kind of hidden from a lot of parents. They don't realize that. So sit down and have that discussion with your kids and talk about God's perspective. The Bible warns us against drunkenness, and it tells us to be clear-minded and to show self-control. And that applies to both alcohol and to drugs, any type of substance. So anyway, some good food for thought there for moms and dads today. It's 11:14, and this is the Faith Radio Network. I'm Bill Meyer. Coming up next, our conversation with Nathan Foster about his new book, The Making of an Ordinary Saint. That's up next.
It's Dr. Bill Meyer Live on Faith Radio. Get ready to join the conversation. Now let's join Dr. Bill Meyer live.
And we'd love to have you join the conversation. If you've got a question for me or for our guest today, you can call us at 877-93-FAITH. 877-93-FAITH is the number. And, of course, you can check us out online at myfaithradio.com. Joining us today is Nathan Foster. Nathan is an associate professor of social work and theology at Spring Arbor University in Michigan, where he holds the Andrews Chair in Spiritual Formation. He's also the Director of Teaching Ministries for Renovare, as well as a licensed clinical social worker, a certified addictions counselor, and a public speaker. He's the author of Wisdom Chaser, Finding My Father at 14,000 Feet. And Nathan isn't just one of those stuffy academic types either. He's also the bassist for a band called Christie and the Professors. And Nathan joins us today to talk about his new book, The Making of an Ordinary Saint. Nathan, welcome to Faith Radio.
Thanks, Bill.
Before we jump into your book, I've got to know a little bit about Christie and the Professors. First of all, what type of music do you do, and how do I get one of your CDs?
Oh, I'll send you one, Bill. It's a band that actually it was birthed out of the book and a project I was doing on the book where I learned to play bass as a spiritual discipline.
Wow.
And as a result, formed a band with my wife, and she sings, writes the music, plays guitar, kind of an indie alternative rock. And that dominates a lot of my life. We play out a couple times a month, and got a website, Christie and the Professors. People can find us there.
I checked out some of your videos. It's good stuff.
Yeah. Thanks, Bill. Yeah,
okay,
we did a video this year from a song she wrote about my writing process of the book, and so it's kind of fun to have a song and video that's really about the book.
We need to have you come to the Twin Cities or to one of our other Faith Radio cities and do a coffee house gig. Let's set it up.
Hey, we'd love that. We'd love it.
would be so fun. Now, a lot of our listeners may be familiar with your dad, Richard Foster, but for those who aren't, can you tell us a little bit about his landmark book, Celebration of Discipline, and his teaching on the spiritual mm-hmm. disciplines?
Sure. I mean, he essentially devoted his public life to writing and speaking. The book Celebration of Discipline, 1978, it was really a good introduction to American Christians, particularly evangelicals, about the kind of rich practices that Christians have been doing for 2,000 years, the spiritual disciplines. And then he went to form an organization called Renovare, which worked an ecumenical movement to help bring the church together and work teach people different traditions in Christian faith and practicing the disciplines.
Now, my perspective is that, unfortunately, the evangelical church has, in many cases, not all, but in many cases, lost sight of how powerful the spiritual disciplines can be in the discipleship and the Christian growth process. Is that your perspective as well?
I think so. I mean, it's hard to say, but it does appear that the early church were very well acquainted with spiritual disciplines, and that being a Christian meant that you do exercises, and that the training was very much a part of discipleship. And certainly people are interested in those things, and people do those things oftentimes for, I think, wrong reasons. But it isn't necessarily something that's really integrated into our church life.
And would you see it more in the Catholic tradition? Would you see, are there particular denominations where you might see a real practice of the spiritual disciplines as part of one's everyday life?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know if it'd be fair to kind of categorize. It seems to me that different denominations maybe focus on different disciplines. And every denomination, I think, has disciplines that they are kind of that's integrated into their communities. What we see in Catholicism and other kind of high church groups is a rich tradition of some of the more contemplative disciplines, which is usually pretty lacking in Protestant America.
So if we go back to the early church, where do we find the disciplines coming from? I mean, did the early church fathers develop these? Who were the founders of the whole idea of the spiritual disciplines as daily practice?
Oh, wow. That's a really good question. Not necessarily would be one to answer that, other than I would say that but I'm a good professor. That won't keep me from talking, right?
There you go.
I will say that at least the 12 that my dad wrote about and the 12 that I worked with in my book are essentially modeled after the life of Jesus. And if you look at the practices Jesus did, we find the disciplines. The idea of habit and developing our habit structures for good, that goes way back, and certainly the early Christians seem to have picked that up and were very aware of the importance of developing spiritual habits.
Now, I mentioned at the beginning of the show, traditionally, the inward disciplines would include things like prayer, fasting, meditation, and study. The outward disciplines, simplicity, solitude, submission, and service, and then the corporate or group disciplines of confession, worship, guidance, and celebration. Did I get them all right?
I think so, yep.
Now, your dad wrote the foreword to your book. What was it like growing up as the son of Richard Foster?
Well, it was an interesting experience, and actually, my first book was about climbing mountains with my dad and getting to know him through that process. It was wonderful in a lot of ways, confusing in a lot of ways, and frustrating in some ways. But overall, I'm really a fan of my dad, and I discovered him much like other people did from reading his books. I knew him growing up, of course, but he kept his work and home life fairly separate. And so it really wasn't until I was older and I started picking up some of his books and going, oh, wow, there's some really good material in here.
That's interesting how he kept those things separate. Was that a deliberate choice on his part? Did he feel like these high theological concepts that he was working on and writing about didn't really apply to family life? What was the reason for that? Has he ever told you?
No, it's a really good question, and it's interesting to me because he's like this now in that we'll speak together or do, you know, different events together, and it's almost like I don't quite know why, but oftentimes those conversations don't so much enter in directly into things outside of the events we're doing. And it's interestingly enough, though, because my father taught me many, many things and many wonderful things about the spiritual life, but he did so without using religious language or, you know, using religious verbiage, but he did so with his life. And so as I look back, and I'm in my early 40s now, as I look back, I can see that he taught me many, many things, but just by living his life and being ordinary person. I didn't realize how influential he was or how influential his work was until I got older. I think he just kept work at work in a sense.
Now, I need to ask you about the first book, Wisdom Chaser. You mentioned that you and your dad would climb mountains together, and when you said 14,000 feet, so I'm assuming that was the 14ers in the Rocky Mountains. So tell me about that experience.
Oh, that was fantastic. So I was 20. I was living in Colorado, and I don't know that I want to say I was estranged from my dad, but I didn't particularly enjoy him that much. I mean, he was like a lot of 20-year-olds. I just was kind of feeling my own way out in life. And one day I just said, hey, Dad, you want to climb the tallest mountain in Colorado? And he said, sure. And so we went on this little adventure and had a great time doing it. And then real organically through the next decade, we just climbed mountains together. And through that process, I really got to know him and appreciate him in so many ways. So that the point when I left Colorado, I felt like I left my best friend. It's a cool story.
That's beautiful. Well, again, that book is called Wisdom Chaser, Finding My Father at 14,000 Feet. And Nathan, I lived in Colorado for 10 years, and my wife has climbed, I want to say, four of the 14.
Okay.
But three of them were really close to each other, so you probably know them, the ones near Breckenridge. So she just did all the summits in one day. But how many did you guys actually end up tackling?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it actually is beautiful that I don't know the answer, because I was very obsessed with the accomplishment in the beginning, you know, kind of master the mountain. And in the end, it just became about hanging out with my dad. I think I'm around 25. I'd have to really sit down and count, but somewhere in that. And some I did a couple. I did more than once.
Any scary experiences? Because my wife in one of those peaks, all of a sudden she got caught in a snowstorm and wasn't really expecting that, her and her friend. Did you guys have any close calls?
We did. I mean, there was a number of, and it was really fun to write about some of those. There was one in particular where I thought my dad had been struck by lightning.
Oh, no.
And we were running down, and there was this, I mean, it was so loud, and this flash, and he falls to the ground, you know, in the fetal position, motionless. And I went to shake him, thinking he was dead. There were a handful of those that, one, I was caught in a lightning storm. The one, I was by myself, caught in a lightning storm and was able to help a family in that. But, there's lots of nature's dangerous for sure.
Wow,
but it was good, you know, and it was really fun to write the book in the sense that it became a backdrop. And hiking up mountains, experiencing nature and the challenges and all that's just a wonderful metaphor for so many things in life and relationships.
Mm, beautiful. Well, I'll commend that book to folks that want to learn more about Richard Foster and Nathan's relationship with him. Now, tell us about the project. We got a break coming up in just about a minute and a half, but just briefly, tell us about this project you embarked on that led to the book, The Making of an Ordinary Saint.
Sure. Well, what I did is I was looking at the 12 disciplines my dad wrote about. And I thought, what if I did a little experiment and practiced each of these disciplines intentionally and intensely, and then wrote a narrative of my journey, the successes and failures, what worked and what didn't work. And I started out with a one-year project, and it turned into four. Hmm. And so the book's essentially divided into the 12 disciplines and my experiences trying them out and trying different things with them and what I found from doing that.
Well, we're going to dive into some of those disciplines and some of Nathan's experiences when we come back. You're listening to the Faith Radio Network. By the way, Nathan's website, if you want to check it out, is nathanfosterprojects.com. nathanfosterprojects.com. The book is called The Making of an Ordinary Saint, My Journey from Frustration to Joy with the Spiritual Disciplines. We'll hear about some of those frustrations and some of those joys up next here on the Faith Radio Network. Stick with us.
Right now, and we want to hear from you. Call us at 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. Now, here's Dr. Bill Meyer again on Faith Radio.
And welcome back. It's so great to have you with us today here on the Faith Radio Network. My guest is Nathan Foster. He is a professor at Spring Arbor University in Michigan. He's also the author of The Making of an Ordinary Saint, My Journey from Frustration to Joy with the Spiritual Disciplines. Mentioned at the beginning of the program, Nathan is the son of Richard Foster, who, of course, is known for that seminal book on the spiritual disciplines, Celebration of the Disciplines. And Nathan, Let's dive back into that project that you were talking about. You decided, and of course, you know, you grew up knowing these things, understanding these things, and then have made it one of your areas of study, and the spiritual disciplines have become a passion, but also a frustration for you. When you started this project, you said it was going to be a one-year project, and then it went on and on. And part of it was to really tackle for yourself personally how the spiritual disciplines could help you grow. You ran into some obstacles along the way. So let's kind of take us back to that project and how you went about it, and then what happened.
Sure. There's much to say in a sense. And I think that at the beginning, I approached the disciplines like I think a lot of Christians, in the sense that these are things that I need to do, I should do, I want to do, and I need to kind of muster all my willpower and get serious, and it's time to be, you know, intense about these things. And through the journey, that attitude and posture, I learned really was a hindrance and not helpful. And really had more to do with my own ego and pride and sense of accomplishment than a life with God. And so what I learned was to quit trying so hard and to just be present to God and to let go of my agenda of what is successful and, you know, what should I, you know, how much should I be praying or how much should I be, you know, working on these disciplines, and to rest in God's presence and to let him lead me into the different practices. So when I started the project, I thought it would be really fun to do these big stunts of sort and to, you know, I'm going to go, you know, do 2 weeks of solitude in the mountains, or I'm going to go, you know, fast for a couple weeks, you know, really intense things. And I almost very quickly, I was unable to get to my stunts of sort, because God kept providing opportunities for me to practice the disciplines in my ordinary life. And that became so compelling to me to find ways to practice these in the midst of the chaos and the stress of my everyday life. It was really quite surprising, but very enjoyable.
What's the danger when it comes to practices like the spiritual disciplines that, you know, you read about Jesus' encounters with the Pharisees, and of course, they were the religious authorities of his day, and they believed sincerely that they were the closest to God, and they were the holiest, and that they were doing everything right. And they, of course, had added to the Torah. They had added all these different rules and regulations and laws, but they sincerely believed they had it. I mean, they were the spiritual elite. And he called them out, and he said, "You guys got it all wrong. I mean, it's really about the heart, and you've failed miserably in that area." So let's talk about that balance. How do we practice something like the spiritual disciplines without it becoming pharisaical, without it becoming legalistic?
Mm-hmm. That's really good, Bill, because so many times the practice of the disciplines can lead us to, being like the Pharisees and thinking we've earned something. And so practicing the disciplines and being really what we would determine as successful with them can be very destructive. And, the Pharisees they practiced with rigor more so than most of us. My sense on learning about the disciplines is that to approach the disciplines as an active response to God's love, that I'm loved unconditionally as I am right here, right now. That's wonderful. And I get to respond to that. And so I enter into a life with God, and I lay down as best I can some choices and moments before God, which is essentially the disciplines. But I'm not earning anything. I'm not trying to make God love me. I'm not trying to be a good Christian to impress other people or even myself or God. I'm just entering into a life with God. So then the cool thing with that is if I'm really successful at them, I can kind of smile at that. Or if I feel like I've grown in that, it's just kind of fun. And I know that it's not necessarily about me. I showed up and God did some cool things. And if I fail at them and I set goals and I don't meet them, then that's not an opportunity to beat myself up and to kind of go into the shame of I'm not a good Christian or I'm not, you know, good enough for all this, but to learn and to just kind of nestle in with God and continue in the process.
Now, along those lines, in your book, you write about some discipline hazards, and one of those is that self-hatred narrative. Have you personally and have you worked and known others who have unfortunately beat themselves up to the extent that they feel like I'm just the lowest of the low, I'm just a worm, and I can't, you know, that worm theology, that I can't do anything right, I can't, you know, God must despise me. And if so, if that's happened to you or others, how do you get out of that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Personally, I've hated myself with the best of them, and grew up with a very, very low sense of self. And you know, when I really started pressing into Christianity as a late teenager, I found places in a culture that really supported that and helped me beat myself up worse. That I, you know, I crucified Jesus and I'm this horrible sinner. And which, you know, there's pieces of truth in, you know, the fact of my brokenness and sin, but that's just the beginning. We start there and then we grow and we get to become wonderful people that learn to love God and others well. I think, and it'd be interesting to do some research on this, I'm sure someone has, but it seems to me that we live in a culture here in America in this day and age that where there is an undercurrent of self-disdain, that very few people feel like they measure up, that they're good enough. And there's a number of reasons for that sociologically, but I think it's a real epidemic. And then we bring that into the Christian life, and it is so destructive. But I think correcting some of that is a very long process. But I think it very simply starts with being in God's love and understanding that and growing in that and learning of His care and acceptance for us, the very beginning of the gospel, this notion. And many Christians, I think, miss it and just go on to working and, you know, doing more and achievement as opposed to letting God love them.
I wonder sometimes, and I've talked quite a bit on this program about some of my concerns about social networking and mobile technology and this whole new Pandora's box that we've, you know, opened here, especially just in the last 10 years or so, and seeing more and more research about comparison and especially with women and teen girls with this issue of not measuring up. I'm not as attractive as my friend. I'm not as good as that other mom who has her act together. Boy, look at her Facebook page with all of her wonderful achievements with her children and her perfect house and her perfect, you know, hosting. And I'm wondering if that kind of feeds in. And you know, I'm not going to blame Satan on all of it, but I wonder sometimes if he's just kind of cackling at us saying, boy, I've got you here. This is a, you know, this wonderful achievement of man, again, made in God's image. And we've used our creativity to, you know, design things like the internet and mobile technology, and it can be used for so much good. And there are so many beautiful things about it. But by the same token, whether you want to say it's Satan or the sin nature or, you know, all of those things, it concerns me that that can add to the beating up of ourselves and even Christians going on, you know, each other's Instagram pages and saying, man, I wish I could be like that youth pastor. I'm, you know, I don't have a youth group that big and we're not doing those cool activities. Talk about that as a possible contributor or danger in today's world.
Oh, it's so huge. And I don't think Bill will really understand it until 20, 30 years out. But it looks as if, and there seems to be enough research to back this, that we're on the cusp of a major change in the human evolution of our mind and the way that we incorporate knowledge. And like, I'm with you, technology has many, many wonderful things, but it can be so destructive. And I do think, I mean, I just assume, this sounds crazy, I assume that my undergrad college students, that the females, I assume that they are just really broken in the sense of how they feel about themselves, their body, the way they look. The damage that I'm seeing, even in the growth in the last 10 years of teaching, is really astounding. I think it's creeping in for men as well. But yeah, I mean, essentially we social media becoming a very dominant voice, and it's wonderful to communicate, but it's also, it's not real intimacy. It's a plastic, it's a projection of what we want, and ultimately it gives a sense that everybody else's life is much better than mine. And we'll play into that in our churches and try to, in our attempts to try and bring people in to make sure we're cool and we look right, which ultimately does have a consequence of making people feel like they're out and they don't measure up, not good enough. We're horrible at this in the church. You know, another piece to it, if I can, Bill, that it's kind of fun to play with is the idea of the growth in advertising. So that essentially the most dominant voice that we're exposed to on a daily basis is people trying to sell us something. And what concerns me about that is that, well, one, that's usually a half-truth. We're very used to being lied to. We don't expect an advertisement to actually be truthful. But the major ploy behind advertising is that you're not good enough, or you're not enough.
Right.
You're lacking something. And whether that's the way you look or the experiences you have or the possessions that you don't have, I think this has severe consequences just in society, but particularly in the spiritual life, because we bring all this baggage into our relationships with God.
It's interesting. At times I'll joke with my wife. I'll say, I'm ready to move to a cabin in Montana. I'm ready to unplug everything and, no electricity, and you can't get broadcast TV, and we're not going to have any electronics in the house, because I'm starting to see, and this is when our family has made some choices when it comes to what we allow our kids to have. They're 12, 10, and 8. And yet I look at their friends, many of them, Christian friends from Christian families, and the impact that this is having on their lives. And as you said, we may just be on the cusp of seeing how both advertising media and social networking, mobile technology is going to impact us. And how tragic, how sad, when I heard you describing those undergraduate women, those young women at your college, and you just assume that many of them are struggling with body image and self-esteem images and perhaps eating disorders. And so much of that, obviously, we're not going to blame technology and all of it, but it's amped it up to a degree exponentially, where a girl at the click of a mouse can compare herself to all of the photoshopped perfect women that are out there. And boy, oh boy, something that I'd Go ahead, jump in.
Oh, the fake women. I mean,
yeah.
we are so used to seeing fake human beings that whenever a normal-looking person ends up on TV or in an advertisement, whoa, what's that? And we'll criticize them and, talk about them like they're not even human and their flaws. It's the impact is absolutely huge. But
there's this
ahead.
Artist. There's
you.
An no. There's an artist from Australia. I can't recall her name. She just came out in the last week and said she's getting off of Twitter because there was some photograph of her at a beach, and the online community just started bashing her for her cellulite. And she's this attractive young woman, and she's on a beach, and they just are ridiculing her. And she said something to the effect of, you know, the social media can just be so hateful and evil, and I'm unplugging from it. And how, you know, this isn't a Christian. She's not a Christian as far as I can tell, but how sad that this is going on every day. So, okay, I'm going to skid off my soapbox here, Nathan, because
well,
obviously
you're
concerned as well.
It's a good box, Bill, and I can actually tie this in with the book and the disciplines if you like.
Yes.
But, you know, one other piece I'd add to it, and where we see this stuff that is beyond just, you know, young people, we're so afraid of old age that people, as they begin to age, become this kind of sheer panic that somehow my worth and identity is being diminished because I look a certain way. And it's really, really sad to me. So it I think, affects cross-generationally. You know, I think it's safe to say that the social media or technology is really an addiction for many people, and a very socially acceptable addiction, one that we encourage each other to participate in. And, you know, one of the things I did in the book was a technology fast, and unplugging. And I did a number of different ones with that, but to use that as a spiritual discipline. To say, God, this thing is pulling at me, so I'm going to intentionally give that up as a way to connect with you. And it transformed the way I use technology by just taking a week away from it.
Boy, that's beautiful. And, you know, a lot of people don't think of fasting in that way. They think of fasting as food only, and certainly that's a big part of what fasting is, but to fast in that way. It's a challenge for all of us to maybe consider, and certainly considering making the Sabbath a true day of rest and unplugging on the Sabbath. Our guest is Nathan Foster, and we're talking about his brand new book, which is basically the spiritual disciplines for regular people. It's called The Making of an Ordinary Saint, and we're going to take a quick break. We have 3 copies of Nathan's book to give away. If you call us and give us your contact info, at the end of the hour we'll have a drawing, and maybe you'll have a copy of Making Him an Ordinary Saint, compliments of the Faith Radio Network. Stick with us.
Now, back to Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio.
Hey, welcome back. I want to say thanks to Bill Hicks at Clear Passage Counseling for his support of this program. Bill is a licensed marriage and family therapist, and if you live in the Twin Cities area and you are struggling with depression or anxiety or relationship issues, I'd encourage you to go to clearpassagecounseling.com and learn more about Bill's services. Again, it's clearpassagecounseling.com. I'm Bill Meyer, and this is our discussion with Nathan Foster, The Making of an Ordinary Saint. Nathan is a professor at Spring Arbor University in Michigan. He's the son of Richard Foster, who, of course, wrote that classic book on the spiritual disciplines back in the late 1970s. And, Nathan, we've been talking about several of the different disciplines. And what are some others that you personally have? Let's talk about solitude for a moment, because a few years ago, I tried really being intentional about practicing solitude and realized how crowded and marginless my life had become, and found a place where I was living at the time where I could just take long hikes, you know, several hours, and often would see no one. I mean, literally not one other human being, and for hours, and just pray as I walked and ask God to just reveal himself to me in new ways. And boy, it was a beautiful experience. Now, this was back before I had kids, and now that I have children, I really, to be honest with you, I have not practiced that discipline. Tell me about your own practice of the discipline of solitude.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's good to point that out, because it's such an important discipline, and probably the biggest hindrance to the spiritual life is noise and distraction. And we specialize in that and are addicted to that as a culture in ways that probably no other human society has been. And it essentially chokes out the voice of God. And I he had a quote that I read years ago that he'd never met a mature Christian who hadn't befriended silence and solitude. And I think there's something to that. I'm a big fan. I very much like silence. I don't always, and sometimes it makes me very uncomfortable. But even, I mean, for many people, just starting very simple and small to take 5 minutes to just be quiet and see what happens. And then we can grow in that. And I'm a fan of taking silent retreats and going for a few days where I don't talk and by myself. Usually the first day I panic and freak out. And feel like I'm going to explode from the deafening noise of the silence. But in the end, everyone I've taken, I come home going, why on earth don't I do this more? I feel more human, and life's difficulties come into focus. I had a great quote from a lady that after Dad and I were speaking once, and she said, I like silence and solitude because it's reliable. And I got her to unpack that a little bit, and basically she's saying, I can just always count that God will be there in some sense, and that things will feel better or look better, even if nothing's resolved after a space, a hike in the woods, right? Very important discipline, very helpful.
I encourage all of our listeners to consider how they might incorporate the discipline of silence and certainly simplicity, which goes right along with it, solitude and simplicity as two core spiritual disciplines. Another is confession. And one of the things you did, which I find fascinating, Nathan, is that you visited all five of the states that you've lived in, and you made confessions to various people about what happened there. Tell us a bit about that.
It was really interesting. It started with, we confess our sins before God, and that's good and such a basis of the Christian life. And my dad made some reference that if that doesn't feel like enough, or if the lingering sense of remorse and guilt is there, confess it to a friend or trusted spiritual advisor or pastor. Very biblical, confess your sins one to another. So what I wanted to do to practice this discipline was to go to a place I'd worked with a coworker and to confess some sins I did at that job, some ways in which I treated the people I worked with that I was not proud of. And after doing that, it was just remarkable. I felt so relieved having done that. And then I looked at my calendar and I thought, I am going to every place I've ever lived this next year. I'm going to make this my redemption tour. I'm going to find a person there and make my confessions for all the things that I did when I was there that I deemed as wrong. It was fantastic. I felt so – I was painful and uncomfortable at times, but I felt so liberated from doing that experience.
How was that received by those people that you confessed to?
You know, my experience has been that it's a regular discipline for me to confess my sins to other people. If you do it regularly, then it doesn't need to be a big ordeal. But my experience has been that if you're thoughtful about who you choose, and that's important because some people are just would be not helpful. But my experience has been so great that people are so helpful in either giving a word of counsel or just listening, reminding me of God's forgiveness. I've found it to be very incarnational, it becomes a very, very helpful experience.
Did you have anyone say, oh, you didn't need to confess that to me, that wasn't such a big deal, or, oh, don't worry about that?
I didn't. I certainly had times where people, it wasn't maybe a big deal, to them, or it, seen as a big thing. Usually people don't see us as bad as we see ourselves.
Thank the Lord for that.
I think I'd set it up in such a way that it was, this was a sacred space and, for just the people to listen. But we laughed, sometimes we confess and we find there's humor in that. We were able to laugh at ourselves and how serious and silly we can be. You've maybe heard that quote, we're only as sick as our secrets. Secrets, they grow and take on lives of their own, and they mold. And getting them out in the light and in the open, we're often able to see them for what they really are rather than what we've created them through the years to be. Very liberating.
Beautiful. Nathan, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate you and this new book. Again, it's called The Making of an Ordinary Saint, My Journey from Frustration to Joy with the Spiritual Disciplines. Nathan's own personal website is Nathan Foster Projects, with an S, projects.com, nathanfosterprojects.com. And Nathan, we will be praying for you and your work there at Spring Arbor and your speaking and writing. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me, Bill. Very much enjoyed it.
This is the Faith Radio Network. I'm Bill Meyer. That wraps things up for today. Coming up next, it's Neil Stavem's Saturday edition of Connecting Faith.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from Dr. Bill Meyer Live. If you'd like more information about this show, just go to myfaithradio.com and click on the program page for Dr. Bill Meyer Live.